Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Nicole Danio, who will be giving us an update about her accessible yoga program. So tell me a little bit about the new class you have lined up in terms of accessible yoga.
Thank you for the opportunity, as always, Cam. This is a class now that's going to be ongoing. It's a class that I've offered a few times in the last few years where it was just a one-time workshop that I ran with Lisa Saran, the woman you spoke with before. She has cerebral palsy, and her and I have been practicing assisted yoga together now for, we're in our sixth year now. So her and I have held these special workshops together, and now it's going to be a weekly class. It will be on Saturdays at 12:30, and that follows the modified yoga class that I've run now for the last 5 years. So the modified class is at 11:15, and that one is for students who have the ability to practice on their own. They don't need necessarily a parent or caregiver right beside them, supporting them with different movements in their limbs and things like that. They're a little bit more able-bodied. And then at 12:30, we're going to have the new class, which is called Assisted Yoga. And that one is for people of any age. It can be infants, young kids, teens, elderly, anyone at all who might benefit. Well, we all benefit from having our joints moved and our core strength engaged. So this will be a class for people who have someone to participate with them. They can stay in their wheelchair, they can bring in their walker, they can use a chair or be down on the mat, but they would have someone with them, and I will be showing both people how to practice yoga, different breathing exercises, concentration exercises, as well as the physical stuff, and both people will really benefit because the techniques that I've created and use, they certainly don't exhaust me as the person who is assisting. So I want assistants to know that they will also be learning really good body mechanics in how to support the person who's practicing the yoga class. So it's going to be a really nice bonding experience. I know that's one thing people have said to me before when they practice this kind of partnership, that it really creates and builds and strengthens bonds, because we all benefit from touch. We all benefit from someone being, right there with us on the journey. And my hope as the teacher is that once the techniques are really learned, a very basic yoga practice can be done every day, whether it's for 5 minutes or half an hour, however long people have. But it's that daily practice that I've always hoped my students get into. And I know that that's very difficult for the ones with very little mobility and ability to practice on their own. So this assisted yoga would give, parents and siblings and caregivers some ideas of different things they can do to move those joints and strengthen the core and get some new mobility in the body. So I'm very excited to share that, and I've already had a good number of people register, so it's a go. And the way those classes run, this is at the Jackson Park Health Center. They register through the Windsor Squash and Fitness Club, which is adjacent to the building. And you buy a six-class pass. And that doesn't mean that the course runs for 6 weeks. It's an ongoing course every Saturday. And people can use those classes at their pace. So I don't want people to feel like, oh, I can't come this Saturday. I'm going to miss out on one of my classes. You buy six classes at a time, and I knock those off. I keep it recorded when you use them. So those six classes are there for people to use, or they can do a one-time drop-in fee and check it out.
So what was the inspiration that led you to want to transform this from a workshop into an ongoing process?
Well, need, the demand for it, because my modified class, as I mentioned, we're in our sixth year now. We're starting up our sixth year this Saturday. We start back up again. And it's been beginning to be attended by more and more people who are coming in their wheelchairs, needing a bit of assistance. And I felt like it was just a little bit, it would be better to create a separate class where everybody can really get the full benefit. That way my more able-bodied participants can continue to develop their strengths, and the ones that have that need to stay in their wheelchair or move quite a bit slower, we can really take our time in this class. So over the last year or two, I've had this trickle in of more and more people who are curious about yoga. They're hearing about the modified programs. They're maybe attending with me at John McGivney and seeing how beneficial it is to have a parent or caregiver with the student. So that inspired me to create the two separate classes and just keep the earlier one for the students who are, just really starting to get those movements on their own. And I can see, and I know from working with Lisa, although she started with mostly assisted, she's able to do so much now on her own in her chair. She knows the movements, she knows the sequences. So I can see down the road that maybe students who start in the assisted program, once they have that assistance, once they get the core strength, once they understand the movements and gain more and more independence, then they would maybe move into that modified class where they don't need the assistance all the time. That's a little bit of what I envision happening, because I've seen it happen with Lisa, where she can come in her wheelchair in that modified class and really participate, even though she's not doing all the same movements. She's doing her modified stuff, but she needed to start with my assistance in order to get to this point. So I'm hoping it becomes sort of a gradual gaining of confidence and awareness where students can then move into the modified class. So we'll see. It's new. I'm excited about it. I already know it's great benefits. This is based on my years now of teaching yoga and doing massage therapy. So all of the techniques and movements and different, lymphatic drainage techniques and mobility techniques, I've incorporated everything that I've been, practicing and doing with people for 17 years now. I'm hoping to share that with those caregivers and parents and siblings who are interested in giving that cool support. I'm hoping that, as PSWs hear about this class, I hope they think, well, that sounds like a fun thing to do on a Saturday afternoon. I'm sure a lot of them are always looking for things to do with their clients. And I'm hoping that this is something, because it really is fun. We laugh a lot. It's great experience. And like I said, it's that touch and that bonding that is really so lovely. So I'm hoping that word gets out and people think it would be a neat thing to try out. And they can do it, like I said, on a walk-in basis, come in once, check it out. And if they like it, buy the six classes, and that way the cost comes down a bit.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
I always thank you, Cam, and I'm going to throw that website out there so people know where to look. So it's www.cocoyoga.ca, and there's just so much information and our radio interviews throughout the years, and photos and videos and different newsreels, so people can really start to see what kind of benefits there is with yoga for everybody, no matter how little movement they have or how skilled they are.
Folks, one of the great pleasures for me as a concerned citizen when it comes to disability issues is just to see the expansion of Nicole's yoga program. Seeing more and more people with disabilities recognizing they have the ability to take part in this, to grow stronger, to just improve their overall well-being. There's nothing worse for a person with a disability than getting stuck, being in that rut that says, I'm in pain, I'm suffering, and there's nothing I can do about it, nothing anybody can do about it. Fact is, you have to try to break out of those patterns in order to actually succeed. But that being said, you can't just go with what someone tells you they think you need. A person with a disability can speak to their own needs, their own heart, better than anyone else. But the truth is, with any condition, regardless, there's always hope. And the more people see that there can be an improved quality of life, the more steps they take towards that ultimate better state of being, the greater life becomes, and the less that perception of just impossibility seems to be, becomes more and more distant in the rearview mirror. It's not always about an immediate cure, but if you can take steps in the right direction, if you live with hope each day, one of these days it will be justified. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Windsor Youth Center is the only drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in Windsor, Essex. WIC provides helpful and experienced staff members and offers several important services such as meals, snacks, opportunities to explore creative expression, resume help, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is open Monday to Saturday from 5 to 10 p.m. and is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East. Get help or lend a hand right here in your community at the Windsor Youth Center.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit more about Nicole Daigneault's latest yoga happenings. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Bonnie Brayton from the Disabled Women's Network. So, the last time you were on, you mentioned some of the issues surrounding people with disabilities and human trafficking.
Yes.
I'd like to have you expand on that a little bit.
Well, I'd like to be able to expand a lot, of course, Cameron, and one of the problems that we have is that there's not good data. And, you know, that is certainly something that came through really clearly through this initiative with the U.S. State Department and their support for this leader exchange that I was part of in June 2017. And again, in terms of, I think some of the things that are interesting in a Canadian context is that one of the other people on the trip with me, a woman by the name of Larissa, and I apologize to you and your listeners and to Larissa because I can't recall her last name, but Larissa heads up the only transition house and shelter for people who are coming out of human trafficking. And her and I were, of course, part of this leader-visitor program together. And I think one of the things that was so interesting and compelling for me about this opportunity, and again, you know, leadership exchanges are very valuable because you learn from each other and everybody is, you know, coming at an issue from a different place. And Larissa said something after she had been on the road with me for a while that I believe was one of her learnings from being with somebody who's a disability activist, which is a truth that I think is really important when we're talking about human trafficking. And anybody who experiences, you know, the kind of violation that you're talking about in trafficking, which is that another person or people control everything in your life, what you eat, where you sleep, what you do. You know, to try and wrap your mind around that, whether it's in the context of sexual trafficking or labor trafficking, that in either case, even outside of what you and I would understand as a person with a disability, the very act of trafficking a person creates disability. Physical disability, and to be really clear, the post-traumatic stress that comes from something like human trafficking can create not only mental anguish or mental distress, it can also actually lead to brain damage. And so one of the other things that was interesting and useful about this learning opportunity between Canada and the U.S., of course, a lot of the research that the U.S. has around brain injury and brain injury, you know, to soldiers, for example, in the field, being not just caused by physical contact of the brain, but also through the post-traumatic stress that soldiers live with following the kind of trauma that they experienced in war. And so where I'm going with this, Cam, is to something that I know that you and I, you know, really want to talk and have your audience and people who are concerned about disability think about, is that the reality is that disability has not even come close to being looked at in a qualitative or quantitative way, in a meaningful way, to understand the size and scope. Because the research Don has done and the research we align ourselves with in terms of, you know, a researcher I've spoken to you about before, Angela Colantonio, have begun to really understand the linkages between the human brain and trauma, whether that is, again, physical or emotional trauma. And so the piece about brain and brain injury in terms of its impact on society and beginning to address that is one of the most critical ways we can create a real win-win between people who are concerned with social and economic development and policy that will create, you know, a healthy Canadian society. And again, I'm not talking about disability, I'm talking about health. And you know, people with disabilities can be healthy just the same as everyone else if they are given the means to have access to health and health care and healthy living and housing and employment and all those things. And I'm doing what I do too much, Ken, which is I'm rambling and not letting you ask questions, so let me stop for a sec.
So one of the key issues you mentioned last time was about those who didn't have disabilities necessarily, but having limbs actually severed to become beggars.
Yes.
Fact is, human trafficking in any form seems to be creating a disability where one simply doesn't need to exist.
That's a profound way to frame it, Cam, and I agree with you, because indeed, that was one of the things that, you know, in terms of the limited research we do have, is that we know through some of the data the U.S. State Department has collected, some of the data from Polaris, some of the data from, like I said, really the U.S. State Department's report is one of the most powerful. There's another one that we have some data from the Office of Victims of Crime in the U.S. that have done some data collection on this. But that piece we talked about, yes, last time, indeed, was related to some instances we know, documented instances of children from Mexico being dismembered and then being brought to Canada and the U.S., to larger cities, and forced to beg for money. I mean, it doesn't get more. I mean, I can't say that, but I'm going to say it is to that degree, yes, that whole frame that we're talking about here, which is that human trafficking is in and of itself something that creates disability. And I started out to try and say something about what Larissa said to others and has begun to say, I think, as well in terms of in a context for her work, because she knew this and she said the connection with Dawn just sort of affirmed something, which is that every person who comes to her transition house, every person who's been trafficked has some form of disability. So whether they start out disabled before trafficking or become disabled through trafficking, that's the end point. And, you know, that's sort of a nice segue into, of course, the work that Dawn does, Cam, right, which is a lot of our time and a lot of our work has been focused on trying to address the needs of women with disabilities in the context of violence. And over the last couple of years, what's begun to be clearer through the research is there's a convergence around women and violence and disability that can no longer not be included in how we look at solutions. And, you know, that transfers across other disability communities, of course, including other people, you know, the trans community, men with disabilities. It is not singularly to women with disabilities, but one of the things I also know is that we cannot ungender violence. So, you know, what Dawn finds itself in the middle of is a very complex point in time where we're beginning to do something that's hard but important, which is to look at social and economic development from an intersectional perspective. That we begin to understand that there are all these different factors that can create disability and that a lot of what has been the traditional notion of disability needs to be set aside. And that when we look at a lot of places where we haven't invested, it's understanding that there's a need to put a significant amount of resources in front of the problem at the front end that none of the politicians seem to be willing to do. Okay.
So in terms of solutions that you mentioned, I'd say one of the keys is actually education, simply talking about these issues. Now, you'd mentioned that you have something coming up that might be of interest.
Yes, thank you very much. There's the Canadian Human Rights Commission has a conference in Ottawa at the end of September. I believe it's the 26th and 27th. 27th and 28th of September in Ottawa. It's called Beyond Labels, and the focus, of course, is on human rights in the Canadian context. And I'm actually moderating a panel. I'm really pleased to confirm that we'll focus on disability and, in fact, disability from an intersectional perspective. And I think, like I said, a really unique opportunity to begin to drill down into how complex it is to address human rights from an intersectional perspective, but the imperative that we do. And I say that without, you know, I don't want to pretend it's going to be easy. You know, one of the things that I tell people all the time is if we start now, in 10 years, we'll have done something. And so this panel, again, with Neil Boulanger from BCANS, Fran Odette from George Brown College in Toronto, Susan Hardy, who is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Disability Studies, and Alexandra Barilli, who is a brilliant professor at the University of Ottawa. And we plan to have a really frank discussion amongst ourselves, but hopefully also with the human rights activists who we expect to be there, the human rights commissioners, the many people who go to a conference like the Human Rights Commission, people who are engaged in human rights, who I frankly feel need to be shaken up a little bit around where they position themselves, which is outside of the disability human rights struggle, looking at it and, you know, nodding in agreement that it's an issue, but not really engaging in that work with us. So we're going to, we hope, really provoke some discussion because they have called this conference Beyond Labels and Beyond Accommodation. And there's an irony to that, I think, for many of us on this panel because we don't feel that there's a beyond in front of us at this point. That beyond, to be frank, and to come back to what I said before, is a good 10 years away. And that's if people have the political will to begin doing something today. Because you invited me back on the show to talk about human trafficking, and, you know, I'm here to say that all I can do is talk about what a big problem it is and how distressed I am that there's zero focus on human trafficking and disability, and that you and I are probably the only people in North America talking about it today, my friend.
So when it gets right down to it, one of the key factors is It's not just about political push to create these better opportunities, these
That's
better
right.
policies. It's also about monitoring, making sure that our ideals and actions match up.
That's right. And it also means, like I said, a really strong push I think we have to make around messaging, like I said, the broader human rights family about collective responsibility. Because, you know, it is not Dawn Canada's responsibility to address the issues of women and girls with disabilities in this country. Our job at Dawn Canada is to create the resources to make it possible for the people who should be addressing their needs to address them. And so we do that through a four-pillar approach, which is through research, and again, much more research on this issue, right, Cam?
Yes.
Through the second pillar is indeed education, and that educational one, like you said, is critical to the other two pillars Dawn uses, which is policy and advocacy. And so I agree with you completely that the first thing, the first thing I think we need, honestly, Cam, is to begin to look at this and to gather data appropriately. I was really struck by the fact that Polaris, which is the largest organization in the U.S. working on human trafficking, had not applied the disability lens to their research. I was able to see it when they were talking about it, but when I tried to discuss that with Polaris, really at a very high level, there was kind of a glaze over, like, that's not what we do. And so we're still at a point, like I said, and that's what I'm trying to make a fine point on, right, Cam, is we're still at a point where even people, good people, who are doing good work and have incredible leadership, have still not understood the disability piece is part of their work and are still not owning that. So, you know, our immediate push and struggle, and again, I think the federal accessibility legislation is a really good lever for keeping that conversation going at a very high level now. We have a real opportunity with the legislation to push out that conversation so it isn't amongst ourselves anymore. Because, frick, you know, that's really part of the problem to me, Cam, is that it's still us talking.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
My friends, I have just one word to describe excluding people with disabilities in human trafficking research. Ridiculous. Whether you can see a disability or not, fact is, these people are being exploited in a horrible way. And how can that not be considered unto itself a disability? How can we look at any major human rights issue without asking the question, how does this affect all our people? Is it just the people that look like us, move like us, communicate like us that we're concerned with? Or is there more to humanity? Is humanity just those that basically come off the assembly line? Or is it a matter of breaking down the impossible standard, saying, you're someone who's suffering because of this, and we're going to include you? Is it a matter of saying, just because you may have a gender difference, a disability, you might think a little different, speak a little different, what have you, we're not going to exclude you from being a part of this research and acknowledging that your suffering, that your rights are just as much as anyone else's. How can it be that anyone would limit their frame so much? Disabilities, some statistics say, make up a third of the world's population. Fact is, some disabilities are unknown, undiagnosed. But these are human beings. They live, they breathe, they think, just as anyone else. And if we don't ask the questions, how does this affect another human being, regardless of what makes them unique? Are we really looking at human rights? Or are we simply looking at the rights of those we're comfortable and familiar with? Ask yourselves that question. Are you looking at all the angles? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.